Today, I'm chatting with Alexia Inger. She is the co-founder and former CEO of online retail giant Cult Beauty, one of the first online beauty retailers. It launched in 2008 and pioneered and platformed digital-first independent beauty brands before any other retailer was doing so. With a focus on storytelling, along with a punchy tone of voice, every product and brand was cherry-picked by Lex and her team, and customers could read exactly why they loved it in the What Makes It Cult section, giving consumers peace of mind that what they were buying was going to work hard for its money. As a former model and PR, Lex learned what beauty products were invaluable backstage, as well as the amount of smoke and mirrors marketing fluff that went on in the industry. And she used that expertise to hone Cult Beauty's ethos, to make it an authentic, trustworthy voice in the beauty space. They were among the first to discover now iconic brands such as Eccentric Molecules and Anastasia Beverly Hills. And in 2018, the retailer was named by the Sunday Times as one of the top 10 fastest growing businesses in the UK. In 2021, Cult Beauty was bought by the Hut Group in a £275 million deal. And a year later, Lex stepped down from the company to start a new chapter with her family. She is now embarking on a new life in Kenya, which sounds terribly exciting. And I'm very grateful she took the time to speak to me. So thank you so much, Lex, for being on the podcast. So I'd love to chat about your time as a model and how that gave you kind of that unique behind the scenes look at the beauty industry. So how did those insights kind of shape your vision for Cult Beauty?
Hello, and thank
Hiya.
you so much for having me on your podcast. I mean the primary view that I got as a model was really seeing the transformational power of great products on myself, turning me from, a normal person like everyone else into a model, and seeing that happen over kind of 60 minutes in front of the mirror with a professional makeup artist, and just really seeing how great products brilliantly applied could really change how you look and completely elevate your look. I think I love the tips and tricks and backstories that came with all of the techniques, and then the beauty finds going through people's makeup bags or the pro makeup kits. And I think sort of it was at that time that I contracted the kind of cult insider product you can't find anywhere bug. And that seems to kind of stayed with me for a lifetime. I mean, there's nothing more exciting than kind of finding that sort of deeply insider gem that no one's heard about, and being able to tell about it. I think I was particularly naive with the industry, but I think modeling also gave me a view into, I don't know, the habitual lies that the beauty industry told women, and how much they kind of preyed on insecurities and fears.
Very patronizing too.
Deeply patronizing. But I still remember I was sharing a flat with a model who she got a very major mascara campaign. And she went off to film it, and she came back from the day's filming, and she was quite crestfallen. I was like, oh, what's this? This is a big thing. How come you're not super excited? She said, it's so weird. This big name brand, international brand, for their mascara, I went in to see the makeup artist. They used the mascara on their kit on me, and then sent me in to do the filming. And that's when I was handed the branded mascara to use. And she's like, they actually used Maybelline Great Lash on me to create the look of this 4 times more expensive
Oh my
mascara.
gosh.
And I was like, seriously? And actually then sort of working with shoots, you'd see, the company would define the look that they want the makeup artist to create. The makeup artist would use their kit to create that look because that's how they did it the best. And then you would sort of go on through to do your shoots or whatever. And it was very divorced from actually what you were selling. And it just felt so disingenuous and shit, that it kind of really got my goat, and it just meant that this sort of pseudo-scientific patronizing marketing speak, it just really started to get on my wick more and more every time I heard it, because it just was, yeah, the whole thing was just bullshit.
And do you think it's a case of it's just all male leadership teams, like board executives, kind of not really giving a shit about the customers and kind of saying, don't worry your pretty little head about that, just buy our
Yeah,
product.
I think that there's an element of that, but it's sort of it's more built into the processes. I think it's the disconnect. The bigger the company gets, the actual disconnect from A, what they're producing, and B, their customers. I mean, it all becomes spreadsheet stuff and what's available on the marketing roster. And actually, when you start to have your marketing department as a brand define your product runway, it is all starting to go very wrong, because it should all come from the customer. And whether it's the customer's needs or actually just talking to them to find out, how they want to use a product, or what annoys them about other brands or other products out there. And people love to tell you. It's like all of the information is there, and even more so on social media. I mean, that said, you can kind of swing the other way, and I've seen brands do that where they're so sort of customer sourced that they kind of forget that they are the editor, that they are the innovator, and people can only tell you from their own experience. And this is a very important part of kind of doing customer analysis, is you will get the corridor that somebody has walked down. You won't necessarily see above those walls when you're talking to them. So yeah, like it's so many different elements come in, but I think that is absolutely the place to start with a new product.
So was that kind of the light bulb moment that made you decide to launch Cult Beauty as kind of a fresh, authentic voice in the beauty space?
Yeah, I mean, I guess meeting my business partner, and we both have had very similar experiences from very different positions. And it was just sparking off another person who was as obsessed as me, and just kind of coming together with ideas of how we would solve the issues that we'd had as consumers.
Because what was the
And
online beauty space? Sorry, what were you saying? What were you going to say?
I think the thing that really got me, is department stores should be like sweet shops to that are kind of beauty obsessive, but I'm actually really intimidated by them. I
Same.
go in there, I feel very
Sensory
pressurized
overload.
and yeah, overloaded, and I want to get out of there. Like every cell in my body is saying get out. And actually, if I'm actually in reality sitting in a room with all of those amazing products, maybe in a much less high pressure environment, it's just the most fun thing in the world. And it's just how do you turn something so joyful and playful into actually quite an assault on your senses? And the
Definitely.
answer is commerce.
Yeah, and you've
Is
got sales
really,
assistants who have targets they want to hit, and it becomes like a boxing match, because you're aware that they want to kind of make
yeah.
themselves targets, and you're trying to kind of dodge the the onslaught of
Yeah, and I, you
sales
know,
speak.
there's different ways of selling a product, but it's a bit like dating, isn't it? Like with sales, it's, if you're really husband hunting, it's very unattractive. You won't You want your sales assistant to be a little bit hard to get.
Yeah, but a bit of an air of mystery perhaps would be quite good. Because what was the online beauty space like when you started out? It was pretty much non-existent, right?
Yeah, I mean, the only other people selling beauty products online were grey market or really kind of salons offloading old stock. Even the department stores didn't have online. They might have been selling a bit of online fashion, but they didn't have online beauty sections to their website. So, yeah, I mean, coming along as a pure play, so without a store. At that time, it was very difficult to convince brands to go with us because they just had this sort of checkbox thing of going with a new retailer. Okay, so what's the address of your store? And if you couldn't fill in the checkbox, everyone just got quite. It's like, well, I mean, we had one French brand saying, "The internet, that's eBay, isn't it?" We were just
Must have
like,
one point of reference.
"Oh." No, they actually thought the internet was eBay.
Oh, the whole internet.
The
Oh my
whole
God.
internet was eBay. And this is
Okay.
like running a brand, I mean, a very big international brand. So it was kind of, you had a big education piece on top of, being tiny we were self-funded at the time. And also, I mean, we spent a lot of time being mansplained by VCs
I can
telling
imagine.
us women would never buy beauty online and that niche beauty would never scale as a business.
Oh my, what was their reasoning behind that?
Probably a chat that they'd had with their wives the night before. Or, I mean, I guess because no one had. And I think, if you, Net-a-Porter had exactly the same. When they launched in 2001, everyone said, "Well, no, people aren't going to buy expensive goods online," because the internet space was very kind of much about finding it was cheap or discount, so it definitely didn't have a luxury feel. I think also the design of the internet, it was very sort of coder focused, so it was quite difficult to make things look luxury because and the format that you could put imagery and usually the coder made the decision about the how big the image could be and because that would cause page load to be too high that would make the image postage stamp and then put lots of text which would be rich text which obviously good for SEO but the way that, and also when we launched Cult there were no off the shelf website options. So you could either go with an Oracle option, which is pretty much the only one, which was £250,000 starting amount, or build your own. So we built our own and it was a deeply glitchy site, but it was very idiosyncratic and I think people just liked it because it looked so completely different from anything else that was out there.
You're kind of the little engine that could at the beginning. And what would you say was the kind of thing that made you succeed in those days? Like when you said you were up against all that kind of pushback, what would you what was the thing that sort of made you keep going and
I think that there's a heavy dose of good timing. Have I gone off?
I can
Oh
still see and hear
no.
you. You.
Can you? Oh
Yeah, I can
man,
still
I'm
see and hear you. Is
sorry.
my audio
Hang
coming
on.
through
I
okay?
might have to switch to phone tethering. There's a power cut as it's a bit shaky. I'm just going to put you. Got you. You're back.
Great stuff.
Sorry.
So yeah, saying about what do you think your kind of secret sauce was? Because I think you were among the first to kind of really embrace that idea of curating beauty products.
Yeah. I mean, curation definitely helped. I think the secret to the success was the passion behind the curation, though. The fact that every single person that works at Cult, from the accountants to the obviously the buyers, but the marketing to, we just attracted a group of people who were equally obsessed with the subject and passionate and loved it. And when our buyers came back from buying trips and in the US, they'd sort of walk in with a box of samples and they would be met at the door. Everyone's like, come on, give us the skinny. Like, what's the latest stuff that you found? And I think when I was interviewing people for roles at Cult, I had one last question that I asked every single person. And it was, if you could only have three beauty products for the rest of your life, what would they be? And what I wasn't necessarily looking for the actual product names, although that was also ended up being quite interesting, but it was more the utter panic going across somebody's face at the thought of only being able to have
I was going to say, I'd
three.
probably be stumped on that one.
I mean, it's a really, really difficult one if you've got a lot of passion. Burps. Can I? Sorry.
Oh, hello.
Please, can I come and find you in a bit?
Okay.
And I'm meeting someone
Oh,
now.
she's super cute.
She's doing cat impressions. Thanks, babes. And can you shut the door? Perfect. Sorry.
No, not at all. Joys of being a
So,
working parent.
no concept of that. So yes, I mean it is an incredibly hard question to answer if you are as passionate about the industry. And you used to get people saying, is that three from each category or subcategory? Or, what about, like, could it just be moisturizers? And that was the thing that I found was the kind of clinch the deal at the end of the interview. It's just really understanding that they saw whatever their role was that they were going for at Cult Beauty through the eyes of our customer. And then the other aspect that was really, really important was our mission to become the world's most trusted beauty retailer. And while those kind of simple words meant very little in 2008, they mean a hell of a lot now.
Definitely.
And it kind of only really grew. So having that as our core mission, kind of behind that, curating the products, is that you're curating to create trust by absolutely nailing it with every order.
So I imagine like trying to win consumer trust online is just so difficult because they haven't got the product in their hands, they can't test it. So I guess it's a lot of it comes down to how you speak to them and the sort of messaging and everything else.
Yeah.
Would you say that sort of was what could
Yeah.
use it?
I mean, I think there's that we kind of set ourselves up as that deeply knowledgeable best friend tone of voice. So it's sort of the best friend that also happens to be a dermatologist, but they'll still tell you when something's not working for you.
Yeah, definitely.
But that was definitely the kind of the vibe that we went for. I think also using humor, so many retailers and actually sort of beauty outlets generally got very, very serious about
Yes.
beauty. And whilst it does have some very serious aspects, not least, how imposing and important an industry it is, especially in the UK, as an employer, and as a generator of tax for for
Yeah,
the
of
UK, the
course.
society and all around the world. It's fun, it's playful, it should be the way that you interact with it should be a playful way.
Yeah, that's the whole point. It's to make you feel good, not just look good.
So we were always very playful in the way that we talked about the products, sort of playful and relatable. And again, that kind of that always feeds back to that being the consumer ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, you had the why it's cult section that every product, you had that little explanation about why you personally loved it. Was there a set criteria that you had, or was it just kind of a gut feeling when you saw
I think
something and thought?
it took a while for, I think, when we put together questions to ask yourself as a copywriter when writing that section. But I think to it took people a while. Like we're starting the new job, kind of writing copy for the Cult Beauty site. It definitely took people a while to really nail that section. It's the that's the heart bit. That's the romance bit. The about the product, the kind of gave you exactly kind of what you're buying. But I guess the why it's cult was the, what is unique about this? Why should this be the moisturizer for you when there are millions out there? And it's kind of just getting down to the essence of what makes it cult.
And conveying that passion that the whole team had, is what you were saying. And I know you were very keen to champion founder-led brands, particularly female-founded founded brands. And I imagine you sort of had a lot of kind of brand stories when people were kind of trying to get stocked. What in your opinion makes a good founder story?
I guess say, I mean, relatability is really key. Journey. So the ability to communicate the journey that they've been on to get there and also the journey that they're going on to make it more interesting. I think journey is important because no brand stands still. It's the story of that evolution that keeps people interested. And even one product brands need to constantly tinker. How can they make sure that the ingredients are the best, the best that can be sourced for that particular ingredient? Or is there something that they can change with the formula? How do they go on a more sustainable journey? How do they go on a more inclusive journey? I mean, the beauty industry's answer to sort of almost anything is make a new product. New. And actually, the brands that excited me the most are the ones that had the confidence not to jump on that merry-go-round. I think Summer Fridays did that really, really well, actually. And they were quite a It was an interesting start because it was sort of influencer brands, like two words when put together make most journalists roll their eyes immediately. But they really, those two founders really got what made individual products sing. And they put so much interesting technology into each of their products, but they also kind of got how consumers used them and they told the stories around that so brilliantly. And now I think they've got funding and they've got people telling them that they need to launch more products and you have to have this calendar. But I think, it does inevitably happen with scale if you've had to take money, if you've had to take funding. Always that point in a brand's life where, and you can see it, I call it the PE effect, and it's you start seeing There's a brand launch every 6 weeks, a product launch every 6 weeks. And it's, for me, it's like the death of the brand.
Yeah, because it kind of dilutes it, doesn't it?
It totally dilutes it. Franchising, franchising of cult hero products. So, they'll have a success with a product and then they'll turn that product into a kind of franchise of multiple different sort of categories around that product's function or its scent or its color or whatever. And it's just a sort of, again, that goes back to that point that I made about marketeers driving your product development. And that is what happens when that is the kind of focus of a brand.
Yeah, I kind of get why they do it. It's like the movie sequel no one asked for, and it's never as good as the original, right? It's just like,
I
it's
mean, it
very
is.
safe, I guess. It's safe territory.
And we're seeing that in so many areas, in so many of the creative areas, whether it's fashion, beauty, film, there's just the people that are holding the purse strings. I don't know that the structure of things means that people are too scared to take chances. So they have Spider-Man 26, 27, 28, or a remake of Mary Poppins. How dare they?
Yeah, I didn't even bother watching that. I was just like, no, not going to happen. Just I'm
I
going to get too
mean,
wound up by it.
guys, come on. There's
Yeah.
so many writers out there with great ideas.
Exactly.
And then you see, when somebody takes a chance for whatever reason, or maybe it's the founders mortgage their house to be able to do it because no one would fund them. I mean, the underdog story always gets me. That's
Yeah, people love an underdog, don't they? I mean, it's kind of.
somebody that's really believes in their cause or what they're, what they're trying to make or create so much that they mortgage their house and they've just put everything out there like a complete nutter. And all of their friends and family have just told them not to. And they're like, no, I'm going to do it. And they always sort of come in a bit ragged, looking quite tired. But then there's a sort of spark or a sparkle in their eyes. And I think that was the thing that always got me with meeting founders and kind of the constant barrage of new brands, new products. It's actually having somebody you can see has got real integrity.
Yeah.
They really understand that they're solving an issue that actually exists, as opposed to creating one.
Creating it, yeah, creating problems to be solved.
And actually just a sort of, I think there's a passion, and then they tend to just blurt out ideas. It's just a, they seem to be this sort of lightning rod for ideas and things that they want to do later. You'll kind of get this sort of, oh, and then there's this, oh God, no, I'm not supposed to talk about that, and da, 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 and then it tends to be very ADD, but
Yeah.
actually it's that's where you get really exciting. I mean, it's when the minute somebody brings out a sort of spreadsheet to explain the market and why this product sits in X, I'm generally asleep.
Yeah.
It whilst that is an important part of the due diligence process of buying, that happens once you've decided you like the brand.
Yeah, there needs to be that passion, that why, that kind of that,
Yeah.
the magic that kind of started it all, as opposed to, like you say,
Want
his.
a mad professor.
Do you think it takes a bit of madness to kind of launch a beauty brand in this kind of
Oh God,
saturated
like you have to be
market?
completely insane.
Yeah. I'm thinking like, why would anyone do that? But yeah, I guess, yeah, if you're that driven and that kind of
Yeah,
in
that's why it's
love
quite
with what you're
good having,
doing.
that's why it's quite good having a duo, because you usually get like the mad professor and then the sensible one that sort of stops them from going under. And I mean, I think the Inky List is quite a good example of that.
Yeah.
And they would be the first to admit it.
They're a husband and wife duo, aren't they, right?
Yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely. That makes it another element to
Yeah,
it.
you've got that Richard and Judy dynamic, which is always
Best dynamic ever. Yeah, so I think, and actually, that would be generally a bit of advice that I would give people on the entrepreneurial journey. It's quite a lonely one. So finding your team, finding your partner that to go on that journey with is actually it helps make it a bit easier. Because the highs are ecstatic, but the lows are very difficult. Just like any kind of obsession, I guess.
How did you deal with that when you were kind of building Cult Beauty? Because I imagine there was sort of tough times where it was moments of sheer terror. What do you think? Is this gonna pan out?
I
Work.
mean, my folks invested some money in the business early on, and I think that really added to the terror, like to the point of like, I cannot actually fail. Like, this cannot I cannot go back to mum and dad and say, I've lost your money. So that was all like always in the back of my mind when we had a bad moment. I was like, oh God, no, please don't let me make that phone call. That was the stick. And then just the carrot aspect is actually taking the time to celebrate when you've succeeded at something, when you've done well, when you've had a good meeting, when you have a new supplier, when you've had great feedback, or when a brilliant influencer has kind of taken on your product to give it a bit of support. Or yeah, I mean, for us, great news pieces that came out. We really celebrated any kind of press that happened, and it was, that third party giving you their stamp of approval. I think all also really fed back into this wanting to be the most trusted retailer, because you can't say trust me. You got to get somebody get to say trust them. So that was a really essential part of our strategy with kind of building the business.
And what was the kind of tipping point where you thought, okay, this has really got legs, we're gonna, really start to build something here? Were there any kind of moments like that where you felt like, okay, wow, this is it?
Yeah, I mean, there were quite a few, but I think when Anastasia Beverly Hills took off as a brand, and it was we had it exclusively because no one really had heard of them, and they were a tiny indie brand, and they went absolutely stratospheric, and that helped us. I think you'd have little step changes, and sometimes it's two steps forward, three steps back, but actually having a runaway success brand just bought you breathing space. It meant that you were getting a funnel of new customers that were coming in passively. So you had your bread and butter, and I think that was a big turning point. Sunday Riley happened. We also brought Sunday Riley to the UK, so we were the first to stop them. And Indian Knight wrote a piece about it was her first column in Style. And she wrote a piece about two of the Sunday Riley products, which she just, it was no holds barred. She just went, this is the most amazing thing I've ever put on my skin.
Wow. And she's like the
And
King Midas of beauty journalists. Like whatever she writes about, it goes
goes
stratospheric.
mental. But that phenomenon wasn't there yet. She was just known as a very respected writer, and it was her first beauty column, and it just translated amazingly. And that was another massive step change for us. It just introduced so many new people to Cult. They then came on to the site and started playing around with, because they were like, oh, I've never heard of Sunday Riley. Indian Nights is good. I don't know, this site seems quite interesting. I'm going to try another one of the brands that I've never heard of on this site. And that sort of then sort of the social media started to become a bit more of a driving force in beauty. And that's when the celebration of the niche and the indie started to take off as a way of buying beauty, because before then it was so marketing driven and so driven by the big corporates with the big marketing budgets that It just they'd shaped the industry like that for so long, and then they lost control of the narrative, and it allowed all these indie brands that were just, so deliciously compelling, to take off, and people would be willing to take a chance on something they'd never heard of before, which just didn't happen before.
Yeah, do you think people were just sort of fed up with, only having like a few kind of brand, the sort of main corporate brands marketing to them and wanted something different? They just wanted a change. They just, yeah.
I mean, I think, that when I said, so just talking to, I mean, I was so obsessed. I just talked to anybody about beauty that would stand still for more than 5 seconds. But when I talked about advertising, marketing, the words that I used, and sort of said the reason I'd started Cult, like just seeing the glimmer in people's eyes, and that I hate that too. And they were waiting to have a different conversation with brands. And actually, I guess it's not just beauty, it was sort of across the board. Consumers were so bored at this kind of broadcast marketing, actually being able to have a conversation with brands and have brands where you saw yourself, rather than the kind of Claudia Schiffer, was also kind of helpful. It just felt so fresh.
And I think the key is for a lot of these brands was to kind of lean into what made them different, to not try and compete with those big conglomerates. But then so many brands still do. I mean, what do you think is the reason for that? Why sort of brands are trying to compete when they should be really leaning into what makes them different?
I mean, I touched on it before, but and as a sweeping generalization, money men don't really have creative imagination. They're accountants, and accountants look backwards. That's what you want in an accountant.
Yes.
But to be an innovator and to create something that, builds movements like brands do. You have to completely go against what's come before and do something just very different. I mean, the issue is this funding comes with responsibilities to shareholders who would prefer to make 10% on a Me Too brand than lose 100% on a not me brand. So I think, that when the minute that you let the money make the decisions on a brand is when it goes wrong. And I think Estee Lauder is a really good example of this. It's, I mean, they're tanking, but for so many years they've just relied on the same formula: broadcast marketing, fear-based marketing. Use new product launches as your driving factor, and just to have that sort of huge disconnect from your customer base.
Because a lot of these big conglomerates are now buying all these indie brands to try and keep up with that market. But like you say, I feel it's kind of like they're missing the point in how they kind of talk about those brands and what they do with them. They're still like using that old framework to try and market them and tell those stories, and
Yeah, I mean, you only
people
have to
want that
look at
anymore.
Reddit to really understand what happens. I mean, the beauty brands get bought by the bigger conglomerates, and you see the formulation changes, the packaging becomes more generic, the wording becomes more generic, everything becomes kind of just a slight taste. The taste of the old brand is there, but the substance isn't.
Yeah, I think the Body Shop is one of the saddest examples of that.
I know,
Talk about them
and
till the
they've
cows come home. I'm
been
always talking
so
about the Body Shop, but yeah, it just makes me, makes me sad thinking about it.
Yeah, it is, but it is a very difficult market. I mean, to have maintained for so long that presence and that strength is an achievement in itself for the team, and to innovate at scale is really difficult. I mean, I think Unilever brands seem to manage it sometimes. They're really the sort of bigger conglomerate that I've seen it work in. But yeah, it is very hard. And I guess the question is, do you need that scale? And I guess that is a question to ask yourself as a founder, is like, do you need to be the biggest X? We're not talking lifestyle brands. Obviously, you need to have a viable business, but you don't necessarily need to be humongous, ginormous. And I think, the future of the beauty industry is kind of going back to the niche and not being greedy and actually keeping your sort of staying in your lane and understand really deeply understanding your customer and just delighting the hell out of them, and then kind of supporting you and actually supporting your business and keeping it as a very sustainable and generative business. We have this story in the West, but I guess it's all over the world now, is this commercial hunger to always, always be huge. But actually, if you're brilliant, is it needed? Do you need to be massive? Because actually, with scale, you start to lose the magic.
For sure. For sure. I mean, sometimes it's inevitable, isn't it? If your product, if your brand is popular and more people, know about it, it's unavoidable.
And that's where you need to make difficult decisions. And I mean, there's always difficult decisions. You're always faced with really impossible decisions, as a, but deciding not to jump on that kind of constant role of newness is the first decision I would always guide people to make.
Yeah, it's a tricky balance though, isn't it? I guess. 'Cause obviously you eventually sold Cult Beauty to the Hut Group. What was that time like, and how did it feel after you'd kind of spent so many years building the brand? Was that just a huge kind of wrench, shall we say?
Yeah, I mean, I guess yes, it is. It's just a big change. And I'm gonna have to I'm gonna have to be quite careful with this one, because I've got a contract where I'm not really allowed to talk about that time. So it's probably better if, can we move to a different question? Because they're quite litigious.
What would you say, if like indie beauty brands today, like how would you kind of advise they if they wanted to potentially sell and scale their business, what would be the best advice, that you could offer them?
I'd say selling a company's very complicated version of selling a product, because it involves humans. It doesn't matter how much due diligence the buyer does, their decision to buy you is always based ultimately on gut. I think building a moat around your brand is the most essential thing if you want to sell your brand for decent money or a decent times revenue. And that moat can be a very engaged social media following, kind of your own newsletter that people definitely interact with. Or it can be kind of patenting formulas or ingredients, but that's a lot harder to do and takes a lot more money. But really thinking about where's the fail safe, where am I completely independent? And this is where the social media following is really useful, is that you don't have to rely on third party sources to get your message out. But in order to build that following, you have to give a lot to the people that follow you. And I guess it's that goes back to that not necessarily being about the growth and the money. I think if you please your customers, growth and money happen.
Yeah, it's a cool organic byproduct of that.
So it is really, and there is so much luck and timing involved as well. It is, and I guess that's not really talked about enough. It's sliding doors moments happening every day with that. And I see that a lot with founders and seeing them kind of selling or taking on investments. What makes an investor kind of make that jump? Because it is purely on, it's the whole thing is just on trust. I mean, it's human relationships. You gotta romance them and prove to them that there's a really amazing future that's got a bit of safeguards. Needs
Yeah,
some
and that's why
safeguards.
stories are so important, right? It's not just for customers, but it's also for, like you say, if you want kind of people to buy your brand in the future, not just your products. I think story is key to all of that, right?
It's utterly essential. And that's how we learn as humans. That's how we communicate. That's how we identify. That's how com what knits communities together. So if you don't have good stories to tell, you need to kind of go away and think about, whether you should do it or what story you can tell.
Yeah, as opposed to, oh, I couldn't find anything on the market, so I decided to create. I mean, yeah,
Oh
that still gets trotted out to this day. I get about 10 emails in my inbox with that line trot, and it's just like, yeah.
it's sort of mad. One of the first things is sort of do a Google and see if somebody else has done the idea, because I
Yeah.
don't know, some people, I don't know, they might, it feels like they just asked their mum.
Pretty much. I mean, not beauty, but there was a celebrity's wife who wrote a series of children's books, and she said, yeah, there just wasn't very much, on the market for children in terms of children's literature. And you're like, what? That is like the most bonkers example I think I've ever heard. So yeah, Enid Blyton and Roald Dahl should just not have bothered, basically. That's the funniest example I think of one of those kind of
It's a good one.
that kind of logic. What would you say were the biggest lessons you learned looking back from your time, the 15 years that you spent at Culp?
I think it doesn't matter how technologically advanced we get, people crave connection. And then the minute you start looking at your customer base as numbers, you start to lose your brand. Connect with people, listen, solve their problems, make them laugh, and they will return.
That's very, yeah, very poignant. In when it comes to, yeah, focusing on who your ideal customer is, because a lot of people say, oh, it's just we sell to everyone and anyone. But I sometimes think it's quite nice to have a focus, that ideal customer in mind, just so you can, get an idea of who you're doing
The
this for, I guess.
curse of choice. We all know that within, especially within the beauty industry, you are faced with too much choice. As a human, it switches you off, and you're much less likely to choose anything. It's like those menus that have Thai, Indian, Italian, and you're a bit like,
Yeah, what's all
oh.
that about? It's just like, just
Come
focus on one. It's just
on. Oh yeah, no, I do all hair types. It's like, do you?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure an ingredient that does all hair types doesn't exist.
No.
Because they're counter, they're completely,
Kind of contradiction in terms, like,
exactly. So really focusing in on what makes you special. And we had that lesson quite early on at Colt, because when we first launched, we were so tiny and we were working out of a second bedroom. We were doing the full kind of Wizard of Oz. It's like pretending to be a muck and always like, when we knew there was an important phone call coming in, like have somebody pretend to be like the PA or, it was so, all of those stupid things. And we got interest in our first 6 months from the president of Free People, who happened to be a customer of ours. I don't know how she'd found us. And she got her head of acquisitions to call us up. And we had a hilarious conversation on my co-founder's bed because we couldn't be in the actual spare room office because somebody else was working in there.
Oh my gosh.
And he was like, "How much do you turn over?" I was at like 5, 10 million a month. And we were like, 5,000 pounds. Oh, okay. So I can see we're dealing with some different scale here. I guess yeah, right. You can see him kind of withering away through the conversation. Wait. She came to London to launch Anthropology in the UK and called us up and said, "I've got a free afternoon. Do you want to meet up?" And we jumped at the chance. And she sort of said, "I don't really, as president of Free People, I spent all of my time trying to come across as a mom and pop store because people love human scale, because that's what they relate to. And you have an amazing benefit that when somebody calls up your customer service, they're talking to the founder and they are going to get the best advice that you will
Exactly.
get from a beauty retailer. Why are you pretending that's not the case?" And we kind of went a bit silent and we were like, "Fake it till you make it." And she just laughed at us and she said, "Really think about what you have to offer that is unique. What is the unique benefit that your customer's getting? They've chosen your brand and shout about it, highlight it, focus your innovation and your investment on that area and really, bring it forward. Don't be embarrassed about being small." And I think that was such a moment of where everything kind of changed for us in the way that we presented Cult. And it was the, yeah, we're small and we're up against like massive brands. And yeah, no one's heard of the brands that we're selling, but they're amazing. And they're cool. And you know what? This person loves them. And this really cool makeup artist owns this. And this is the look that it can create. And just slowly, slowly using these stories to build up that brand, that kind of cult following. It was, if we hadn't had that bit of advice, if we hadn't had that kind of gentle slap across the face, cold water thrown on us a little bit, we would have kind of carried on kind of pretending to be, just a another
Space and
big,
K.
yeah. So I think that would be sort of another bit of advice is really double down on what makes you different, even if it's something that feels a bit quirky and
Like what we're doing with Smart Beauty, like we're not like a big marketing agency. There's like a handful of us, but like what you're saying, we're super passionate about what we're doing. We all come from editorial backgrounds, and we're just obsessed, ridiculously obsessed with beauty. And hopefully that kind of sets us apart, and some people will be into that.
Absolutely, because it means that you're living it. So you're working it, but actually in your free time, you are, you're reading all of the supplements, you're reading the blogs, you're reading the Substacks, you're kind of there really understanding how people react to different brand stories. And yeah, I think I mentioned the newsletters before, and I think there's definitely something. In it feels quite an old-fashioned marketing channel, but actually, I think newsletters are very
They're so
interesting.
great because it's a captive audience and you're not relying on a platform or an algorithm for people to see your content. Like it goes straight to their inbox. So there's no
Exactly,
middleman.
that kind of back to that thing, a customer moat, having email addresses where people have given you the permission to write to them and they open your emails. That is so golden. That is so golden as a brand. And I think, even if you just have 250 people that do that, it's a very interesting start. But you've really got to think, why would they open your email when they have 300 emails a day?
Yeah, exactly. So there's that to contend with. What was the most sort of successful marketing channel for you at Cult? Was it the newsletters or?
Newsletters were really, really important, because that is your bread and butter. And also sort of segmenting them so that you know the people that really want to read deep into beauty, and then there are people that just want, the sweeties at the checkout, or they want to know which kind of the problem solving side of things, or who's recommending what. Newsletter is really important. Instagram was really important for the storytelling side of things, and I think the copy on our site, it was really, really important that every word's written by an amazing journalist or a brilliant copywriter, or people that really sort of understand beauty and how to actually write about it.
I really loved your tone of voice. It was kind of that kind of Tatler magazine, tongue in cheek, but it was still sort of had that luxury feel, aspirational feel to it, but it didn't take itself too seriously. I think it's kind of a British thing, isn't it? Where we don't want to be too kind of, we don't want to take ourselves too seriously. There's got to be that kind of cheeky element to it.
Absolutely. And like people would say, they would comment to say, I just like really, really just like reading your website. And it's kind of a really good thing to say about a retailer.
Yeah, that's really lovely, because who just sort of hangs around on a website just for. Yeah, like an e-commerce website, should we say, just for the editorial. I mean, it's got to be something pretty special for them to retain the attention of people, given that the short attention spans people have online. And what's the most like what was your like proudest moment from that time, would you say, or the sort of biggest achievement?
I guess it was sort of in our way, we helped change the industry. We helped change the way that beauty speaks to women, which is kind of, and I mean, and then increasingly men and increasingly people of all genders, really. Because it was so boxed in, and non-inclusive, and I think we did help change that conversation. I think we also changed the way that people looked at indie beauty, and as a kind of viable category in its own right. I think the things that I really enjoyed the most was sort of things like launching the female sexual pleasure and wellness sections, or
Such an interesting category now, with like sex positivity and that all those conversations that are happening that weren't happening years ago. I love all the crossover with sexual wellness and hormonal health and all of that. That
I mean, focusing on the menopause, working on the campaign to get menopause seen differently by the government. Actually changing the law, helping change the law, that kind of, when you have built up this following and built up this social media, to actually be able to use that for something positive. So deeply proud moments there. I think, with me, it was all about spotting the trends before they happened, and kind of being the first to kind of feature a way of I don't know, a product, or a kind of an area. I mean, we were the first to sell Korean beauty, and that was a very a good example. We kind of, I say, sell, like the first sort of 2.5 years that we had Korean beauty on the site, we didn't really sell very much because people didn't really get it. But then
Then it really
suddenly
took off, and
exploded. And we rode the wave when it did, but it's kind of having the courage of your convictions a bit, like, oh, okay, there's no search terms for this. And when you put up a couple of brands within that kind of trend or category and no one buys anything from them, then everyone suddenly goes, oh, we need to withdraw this. And but actually you say, no, we have to keep, I think this is a thing, I think we keep going at it, because if you are an innovator and if you are doing something new, it takes a while to catch on. It's never an overnight success. You have to be there ready for the overnight success to happen.
Yeah, and then you can say, like, look, I told you so.
Yeah.
It's a lovely moment when that happens, but yeah, it's just kind of hanging in there until it does.
Like those mansplaining VCs. There's I have like little daydreams occasionally where I go back to those guys and do a sort of pretty woman moment.
Big mistake, big, huge.
Huge. Because we have to shopping.
Oh my God. I remember I worked for this online magazine, and one of the sort of men in charge of the company the magazine was for, I wanted to do an article about periods. And this is about like 15 years ago. And he was just like, well, no one wants to read about that. Like, who wants to? It's like, well,
No.
you might not, but other people, like half the population, might be
Do
interested.
with reading a little bit about it.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's I love moments like that where you're just like, okay. Do you think beauty can be a force for good? Because there's a lot of trash talk about our industry and like how it's toxic. And I'm not saying that there isn't kind of a toxic element to it, and that there aren't, these kind of pressures and sort of beauty ideals that people are, like you say, brands are still playing on women's, like, everyone's insecurities and creating problems in order to sell products to solve them, quote unquote. Do you think it can be a force for good?
I
All that
think
considered.
it already is. I mean, from the point of view of the industry, like it supports so many sole trader businesses. You so many people work within beauty industry, and I think it's a very positive category within the UK, within society. Just from the point of view of employment and the kind of money that it brings into the tax coffers. I think, we need to get over this overconsumption side of things, because it's just not cool and it's not modern. And actually, it's that I talk about the granification of beauty. I think, if we look at a kind of utopic view of the industry, is like going back to those make do and mend ways of being, where you buy one exceedingly good thing rather than kind of have your head turned by every sort of flashy thing that
Cheap little
goes by.
trinket.
And for the beauty industry to really become what I think it can become, it needs real buy-in from the consumer, because it's not convenient. This is the problem. To be a conscious consumer is a slightly inconvenient lifestyle. And we've all become so used to that convenience that it's a difficult one. But I think people really understand now what they're voting for with their money, and understand how essential that pound is when you put it towards a generative business that, pays people properly, that looks at their supply chain. And they're out there and they're amazing. There are some really amazing businesses that do that. So I think, that it's down to the consumer to really take on board that they do need to change their habits a bit. And then I guess the brands that are doing these amazing things, to make sure that they're talking about them and talking about it in not kind of sitting in the CSR part of their website that is actually kind of front and center messaging in an exciting way.
Because you get these kind of purists who say, oh, if we did away with beauty culture, we'd all be a lot happier. What would you say to that?
Well, beauty culture is a very big term, but I think it's the societal pressures that have built this culture, which is essentially culture, not beauty culture. It's like it is our culture. So I think it's, I've totally lost my train of thought. Sorry, this is where, that is where the tiredness.
I'm on exactly the same page as honestly. I totally get the sleep de deprived. Like, what did I come in this room for? Like, yeah.
Oh God, spend my life halfway up the stairs.
Is there
What am I
anything
trying?
wrong with like wanting to look good in and of itself, would you say? Wanting to look good and wanting to smell good and have people tell you look good. It is nice, isn't it? It's like, is this
Nice.
really a bad
It's
thing? Am I a victim of
I guess
society?
it's the definition of good, isn't it? It's quite, it's so broad because generally so much of the kind of the beauty ideal is very very focused on youth and fertility, but looking good can be so many different things. I mean, looking exciting or colorful or I don't know, there's just refreshed.
Yeah,
Like you
less tired. That's what I'm aiming for at the moment. Less tired. Like, not necessarily like younger, but just not knackered. That's what I'm kind of aspiring to these days.
The upside of that is that the more knackered you are, kind of generally, the less it takes for people to think you look good.
That's true. The bar is very low at the moment.
Drop the bar down right to the floor. You brush
Yeah.
your hair once, and everyone gets very excited.
Yeah, that's good advice. Moving, like, I think I'm gonna take that with me moving forward. Just give them nothing, and then anything you do, it's like it's amazing. Yeah, so I love that. It's very Anna Delvey, I feel like, so that kind of approach. And what's next? Finally, what's next for you? I don't want to take up too much of your time, but what's kind of on the
Well, I
radar?
just had a baby, so I'm very much enjoying being able to be a mum this second time round, like really, really focused on being a
It's a
good
lovely
mum.
stage when you're in that little love bubble, like postnatal love bubble. I mean,
It's quite a privilege.
it's horrific, but it can be also really lovely.
I
It's
made
kind
it
of
through the night.
starts.
And I think also, I guess I'm taking some time out to kind of nurture other obsessions, because really, who knows where that will lead? I wasn't working in beauty when I started Cult Beauty. I learned the industry on the job. I just loved it. And maybe by kind of going back to the things that I really love doing, then who knows where that will take me.
Yeah. What kind of things? What are your kind of main?
So getting very into well, growing vegetables, growing like sort of gardening, but then that led me into permaculture and soil health and then looking at food forests or regenerative agroforestry. So this is an
Oh
area
wow,
that I'm
we're getting like heavy hitting stuff. This isn't just like growing a few carrots here. We're talking like this
No,
is,
it's like
yeah, serious stuff.
the food industry is broken, and it needs some very big changes. That's the first time I've heard an ambulance.
What do ambulances
Okay.
sound like there?
Something from the 1950s, which they
Yeah, I love
probably.
it how like sirens in other countries sound. Some of them are quite like melodic, some of them sound like ice cream vans. So it's like
I don't. I mean, it's going very slowly. Anyway, sorry. Yes, I mean the food industry is broken, and especially from the point of view of creating food at any kind of scale. And I think that this is an area that really, really interests me. So regeneration of soil and how that could change how we grow our food.
Oh, wow. Yeah, watch this space.
So it's a bit different,
Yeah.
really.
Yeah, always good to change it up. Well, can't wait to hear what you do with all that and what your next kind of in your next project. But yeah, thank you so much, Lex, for chatting with me. Really appreciate it, given that you've got an 8-month-old and a 5-year-old. Imagine your time is very, very precious at the moment. So I really do appreciate you speaking with me.
It's really cool.
Thank you so much. But yeah, but I'll let you know when it comes out and send you the link to the episode. But no, it's really lovely catching up and hopefully speak to you soon.
Yeah, wicked. Well, thanks very much. I mean, it's been really fun.
Likewise. All right then, Lex, we'll have a lovely day and we'll speak soon. Thanks again. Bye.